Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City, friends. Yes, hey, at NOLA Drinks, if you're looking for a little job advice, if you're on the job hunt, especially if you're looking for a short-term gig, just send your resume over to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. There you go. There'll be some openings. There are some openings. There's still plenty of openings. Friends, we had a good show here for you today. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit. We were out there at Agave Week, which is going on now, and Top Taco, which is happening this evening. Get to that in a second. But we talked to three guests connected to Agave Week. We talked to Luis Navarro, who is the brand ambassador for El Tesoro Tequila, one of the sponsors of yesterday's industry event that I'll talk about in a minute. Eric Rubin from the Espiritus Group, which in their portfolio is Blue Nectar Tequila, a very fine tequila that has just made its way into the Louisiana and New Orleans market. And we then talked to Evan Meeker, who works for Del Maguey Mezcal, a very, very interesting young man who is incredibly knowledgeable about Mezcal, very passionate about it. And this includes things connected to social issues, environmental sustainability, as well as just crafting a wonderful, wonderful artisanal liquor, I should say, spirit. That's what it is. And then we're going to talk to Bernie Lubbers, who Bernie is the brand ambassador for Heaven Hill Bourbon. And he's a really interesting guy. Used to be a stand-up comedian, has kind of recently become a musician. And what he does is he does this really cool presentation where he ties in bourbon and bourbon tasting, obviously Heaven Hill stuff in this instance, to bluegrass music. And as we know well here in New Orleans, music and food and drink are just inexorably linked. We know that. We talk about this on the show all the time. I don't need to tell any of you that. If you're not from here, you probably heard me say that enough. And if you are just listening to the show for the first time, then that's something I've just taught you. So there you go. But yeah, he, in the case, obviously, of Kentucky, bluegrass music, its history, along with bourbon and its history, are just so tied together and go hand in hand. So the idea was basically pairing bluegrass music and bourbon. So then we interview Bernie. We talk a little bit about his presentation, a little bit about his background. Of course, we talk about Heaven Hill Bourbon, and that's a lot of fun. So yeah, you know, friends, this whole thing's going on this week. Top Taco is happening right after the show ends. If you're listening on the radio over at Waldenburg Park from 7 to 10 p.m. As of earlier today, there were still just a few tickets available. It was down to like 300 or something, maybe 200 or so, but you might still be able to get your hands on that. Really fun, all-inclusive event. Ticket prices aren't too expensive. Once you get in, it's all the tacos you can get your hands on from all kinds of different restaurants around town. Some you might expect, meaning Mexican restaurants, and some you may not expect. Some of the traditional restaurants and others are actually making their spin on a taco. And then there's also a bunch of cocktails and a lot of bars and bar programs teaming up with different brands of tequila and mezcal. And there's a competition. There's a People's Choice Award, so you can go and vote for your favorite taco, a traditional taco, a creative taco, and then same on the cocktail front, traditional and creative, so traditional really margarita in this case, and a creative can kind of be anything. And then we're having a judging component to all this from not only the People's Choice, but so-called celebrity judges. Why I say so-called is I've been asked to judge this competition. So probably what happened is that there was one slot left, so they got real celebrity judges, and then they asked me just because they couldn't find anybody else. But I'm really happy to go out there and do that. That's going to be a lot of fun. 7 to 10 at Waldenburg Park. Go check it out. Yeah, friends, I was talking a little bit about this industry event yesterday that took place. It was at the Audubon Aquarium. Lots and lots of stuff to unpack. Okay, so here's what happened. You know, there was a tequila judging, not a cocktail judging, but a tequila judging by professional judges. They then did a guided judging, where people could team up with the judges and learn how to judge tequila. Really interesting, and mezcal as well. Really interesting stuff there. Lots of interesting presentations that went on. And then at one point, one of the last things, really the last thing we did in the early afternoon was an industry panel discussion that I had the great fortune of being asked to moderate. It was a really, really fascinating conversation. And what we had is different folks from different facets of the agave industry. Agave, of course, being tequila and mezcal. And so we went from producers all the way to people who are in retail and bartenders. We asked a lot of interesting questions. We talked about the state of the industry, some of the things to take away from that. What we're seeing is that tequila is probably the hottest growth segment in the spirits world, but where we're seeing the growth is really in premium and super premium, so-called super premium categories. The commodity stuff, the cheap stuff, if you will, is really pretty flat. So that was a really interesting thing that came out. Now, what do I mean by commodity? Typically, when you say tequila has to be made, it's controlled by the government of Mexico. Tequila has to be made using agave, and the sugar for the alcohol has to come from the agave plant. Now, what people will say, the higher end tequilas will say from 100% blue agave, and that's the agave that has to be used in tequila specifically. But they will say 100% blue agave. That's the good stuff. What I mean by commodity stuff is the cheaper stuff. It's referred to as mixto, but you will never see this on a bottle. What that means is that people have to use a minimum, and they always do this, 51% agave sugar, and then any other things like cane sugar or sorghum, things like that. And that's generally the not so good stuff. It's less expensive, but that stuff's flat. It's the premium stuff, the handcrafted stuff that's driving a lot of that. It was also interesting to learn that a lot of brands that are out there that are making headway in the market, as you might imagine, in these two categories, premium and super premium, they might even be owned by big, larger brands or larger portfolios, but are still trying to maintain a dedication to, making it the old-fashioned way, if you will, the traditional way. And there are lots of reasons for that. One is the quality, of course. Two is that it's environmentally and socially more responsible. And we'll talk about that in the closing segment a little bit, because that was one of the categories that we got to. There's something's got to give here in the tequila world, friends. We have these shortages of agave that happen. That plant takes a long time to mature. Prices are artificially low, especially with the cheaper stuff. And that's a lot of what we talked about too, are things that have to give. And we'll touch on that in the last segment when we close out the show. One of the other segments that we did, so we did a state of the industry segment. We did an in the glass and at the bar, as I called it, segment. And then the social issue segment, environmental and social sustainability. And as I said, we'll get to that. The in the glass and at the bar stuff, what we were talking about is kind of moving from this idea that tequila is for shots. No, look, the good stuff is not, I mean, look, shots have their time and place, and I want to do a good shot, but a lot of this really well handcrafted stuff from agave, these great tequilas and these great mezcals, one, you know, enjoy them neat or enjoy them on the rocks, savor them as you would any fine spirit, any fine wine. They're also, some of the better stuff can really perform well in craft cocktails. Now, some of these really, really good ones, you probably don't want to bury them in any sort of cocktail, no matter how craft it is. But that being said, there's a lot of changing perception, at least from the consumer. Again, moving from shots to snifters, as I called it. And we talked a lot about its versatility in the cocktails, taking maybe classic cocktails and swapping in tequila, for example, as the base spirit. One of my favorite examples is the Negroni, of course, made with gin, Campari, and sweet vermouth. I love swapping in mezcal, that smokiness that you get on most mezcals. Really wonderful in a Negroni, I think, plays really nicely. Takes some of the edge off from the sweet vermouth. Great example there. So we talked quite a bit about that as well. It was really interesting to get, especially a lot of the bartenders take. A lot of the bartenders indicated that consumers were more knowledgeable, want to explore more. We talked a lot about how us in the industry, meaning really them in the industry, but bartenders, producers, brand ambassadors, these things, they, you know, it's incumbent upon them to educate the consumer on what's out there, ideas of how to enjoy tequila and mezcal, and educate people on the reality of where we're going with what's probably going to happen with the price, or what's going to happen with these premium brands versus the cheap stuff, and what that's going to mean to really what's in your glass, what you're tasting on your palate, and what's coming out of your pocketbook to pay for one of these bottles. And again, we'll touch on that when we circle back a little bit later on in the show. Friends, we're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back and talk to our guests from Agave Week that I mentioned earlier. Those will be the next three segments. And in the second half of the show, Bernie Lubbers from Heaven Hill Bluegrass and Bourbon. And then we're going to close out the show. Come on back.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next next door at the W Hotel.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks, friends, for tuning in. As always, as you know, we are here at part of the Agave Week event sponsored by the folks at Top Taco. And one of the companies sponsoring this particular event today, an industry seminar and panel, is El Tesoro Tequila. And I am pleased to be joined by Luis Navarro, who is the brand ambassador.
Yeah, sounds a lot fancier.
That was yeah. That was all really good,
I
man.
Love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no. You're looking good too with the hat and the pocket square, man. It's radio. We're getting some pictures, but yeah man. So really cool. So
thank you for having me, by the way.
Oh, my pleasure, Luis.
To be here in New Orleans. I love New Orleans, and we come here honestly for Tales of the Cocktail every year.
Sure.
But it's so nice to be here around this time because it's cooler. You can really enjoy the city, I feel like, a lot more, too.
Right. And you get to get out of that circuit between
exactly.
the Hotel Monteleone and the Royal Sonesta and see more
of the city. There's a lot more to the city.
Exactly. So where are you based out of, Luis?
I'm based in San Francisco.
Oh, you are? Okay.
So, yeah, I've been there for about 8 years. I've been working in those actually 10 years now in the tequila industry and working with different brands, but feel very fortunate to be working with El Tesoro Don Felipe.
Yeah, how did you find your way working with El Tesoro?
El Tesoro, well, I used to work with a different supplier before, and I just found out about this position, and it was an amazing, it's kind of like a dream job, you know, to work with a small brand, but also it's very respected, and then that has so much influence on the agave industry as well. They're trying to do so many different things in the industry to make it, improve it, and make sure that we have enough tequila for many, many years to come. Otherwise, we could be out of tequila for a while
or paying $300 a bottle at minimum. Yeah, and then, you know, something, and one of the things, you guys sponsored this event today, and you gave a presentation uh-huh. on the tequila production and the methodology that you all use at El Tesoro, yeah. and I was interested to learn that you guys really do rely on a lot of the traditional methodology to make your tequila.
Absolutely. I think that is the biggest thing about our brand, is that we focus on what was made by Don Felipe Camarena, who was our, you know, founder. Now it's Carlos Camarena, who is our master tequila, who's his grandson. But everything that is done has to do with the traditional process and to create a flavor that tastes like a tequila, like an artisanal tequila. And everything is inefficient, to be honest. Every single step is inefficient. There is no efficiency in this. But that's not an issue to us. It's that we want to have a final product. It's making, you know, harvesting those agaves at their full maturity. It's, you know, using the traditional stone ovens. It's also using the Taona wheel, which is a two-stone volcanic stone, to crush and grind it, which, you know, not a lot of distilleries use that anymore. We're 100% Taona process. But we are committed to making sure that we create a flavor that was very traditional to the industry.
Yeah, and when you said too, and I think I caught this in the presentation,
yeah.
I think a lot of people maybe don't know this, because you think, okay, you're harvesting an agricultural product for a drink, say like wine grapes or something like that, and you're pretty much going to go through your vineyard when it's time to pick, and you're going to pick every cluster.
Now,
I know people do wave picking and some other things, but with the agave plant in particular, we get different rates of maturation.
Absolutely.
So you guys are going pina by pina, more or less, right?
Absolutely. It can take up to 3 years to actually fully harvest of one field.
One block, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Because like I said, it could take 6 to 8 years, 10 years even, depending on the plant. And one thing that's amazing about La Alteña distillery and Carlos Cabrera is that he's committed to the actual farming of the plant as well, and to making sure that there's a biodiversity. So he actually partnered with the University of Mexico to be part of the bat friendly program.
Yeah, with the long-nosed bats.
Yeah.
Right? Yep.
They are the pollinators of the agaves, the main pollinators that can travel up to 80 miles in one night. But for a while, they're becoming extinct. And they were the ones that were cross-pollinating. So we were seeing a lot less of diversity, and we are seeing a lot less of diversity in the plant. So we are committed to doing or the distillery is La Alteña, is committed to leaving at least 5% of all of the fields to grow to its full maturity, to let the quiote fully grow.
So basically, so it flowers, correct?
So it flowers, and then can be pollinated. Yeah. And then actually bats can actually cross-pollinate. We're hoping that maybe in the next couple of decades you can see a change, or we can start seeing some more genetic diversity between the plant. Because right now it's pretty much the same clone of the plant throughout all distilleries.
As you said earlier in your presentation, and that's a critical issue in all of this, is because when you basically, it's really monocropping what we're talking about here.
Exactly.
When you get to that point, some sort of disease shows up or something, and there's no biodiversity to protect against that. And we already know that the agave plant is naturally... basically can defend against a lot of this stuff through its own natural evolution.
Right.
So it's got some barriers, but we got to help it. Now.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what I think that's what Carlos is doing and our brand is really committed to doing as well, is that we want to make sure that there is enough tequila for us to be drinking in the next 20 years or our kids.
Yeah, right.
And not our kids, but
yeah, making sure we have the bats.
To make sure they drink responsibly.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. There you go. There you go. You know, you cultivate it.
Yeah,
right?
You know what I mean.
There's a tradition. This is New Orleans, Luis. Yeah. So, you know, having a little bit with your parents on the holidays is fine. That's all right. Well, Luis, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with Top Taco, and you did sponsor today's industry event with the panel and your presentation and lunch and everything.
Yeah, so the way we got involved was actually this last year when Tales of the Cocktail, we actually were here to do an activation. So, and Shane, and I believe Shane with Top Taco actually came to our activation here and saw what we were doing with El Tesoro. Carlos Camarena there. And we were doing a full, like, 360-degree view of our distillery. He really loved that. He contacted us about Top Taco, and we thought it was an amazing opportunity to partner and really showcase our brand and, you know, talk a little bit more about what we're doing and, you know, kind of bring it up to people's mind and to talk about a traditional tequila. So we thought it'd be great to be here in New Orleans and support the city, too, yeah, and the event. Yeah,
great. Now you're going to be out at Top Taco tomorrow evening
be there doing tastings of El Tesoro. We'll be doing some cocktails. I think there will be also some of us at the VIP tent, but we will be there serving up a lot of cocktails and a lot of tequila. Traditional tequila to taste.
That'll be fun. Are you partnering up with a particular set of outfits? Are you,
outfits?
You doing that with the competition? Well, like restaurants or bars to use your brand in the competition?
I'm not sure if we are. I have to double check with that, but I think it's just going to be us for what I know. We are doing a couple dinners and different events, which I think is on the agenda or the Agave Week schedule. I forget exactly where because I just came and I'm just...
You just got here? Okay, yeah. Got you.
I've been running around.
Other people know that information. Right, right.
I'm just going to take me.
I dig it. Well, one thing that you guys are doing here too is that you have a really cool... You just gave your presentation and you have this really neat little bar set up where people can cruise through, choose all kinds of different things to rim their glass and then take it to the bar and have a cocktail made with your selection of rimming.
Yeah, so we're calling it the Spice Bar. And basically what we're doing is in the traditional or pre-Columbian days of Mexico, there's still actually use a molcajete, which is like a traditional mortar
pestle.
Exactly. And basically it's similar to our Taona process because the way our Taona crushes our agaves, it really imparts some flavors and some more complexity into tequila because it's natural stone crushing the agaves. So here we want to kind of demonstrate how you can actually amplify certain flavors and spices and actually use that for your cocktails, for create your own spice room using salts, sugars, whatever different ingredients. We have stuff like pineapple, rosemary, rose petals, black salt, cumin, whatever you like. And you can grind it up. And whatever you think, you know, pairs well with a cocktail, use it, pair it, and then drink it. It kind of brings a little more a depth to the cocktail.
Hey, there's another euphemism here. I think I'm going to use that word in describing this. Is people have to work for this a little bit. So making agave distillates and traditional methodology is kind of hard.
Yeah, and it is. Exactly. We know for our tequila, we work really hard to create a really good product. So you have to work a little bit.
I like it. It's teaching people to appreciate it. It's a limited resource, natural resource.
Exactly.
Well, we got about a minute left. Tell us what this cocktail is that we're tasting.
Yeah, so what we're tasting is right now we have what we call El Alteño. And it just kind of brings back some flavors that remind us of the area. So there's some mango because, you know, you go to Mexico, you see all these like stands with fresh fruits and stuff like that. So we use a mango puree. We also use Ancho Reyes, which is like a
chili spicy liqueur
to kind of bring out the spice, because I love spice and it's a very traditional thing of Mexico. And obviously the shining star in this one is El Tesoro Blanco. So it pairs really nicely with the mango and the spice.
Sure.
And then it's also finished off with some garnish of mint to kind of bring the freshness out a little bit more too.
It's nice and refreshing.
Exactly.
Luis, well, do me a favor in the last few seconds we have here. Tell people where they can find El Tesoro online. Website,
yeah,
Facebook,
so
that sort of
there's
thing.
Different places where you can find it. Our website is being updated, so you can actually find different places to look. But one place that I know that definitely has it, I don't know if there's a BevMo here, but some of your smaller stores definitely have it too, like smaller retailers that sell liquor, tequila.
Certainly in a lot of bars around the city.
In a lot of different bars around the city.
But is it eltesoro.com or?
It is eltesoro.tequila.com. Eltesoro.tequila.com. We also have an Instagram page, Eltesoro Tequila. You can follow us, which will be a lot more new content. And one thing you have to note is that our bottle is changing packaging. So right now it's a tall, square bottle. But now we have a new bottle that kind of showcases our story a little more. It has a Tawana closure on top.
Oh, that's cool.
It's a little rounder. It has a little bit more about our agave and our history on the actual label itself, too.
Great. Awesome, Luis. I appreciate it, man.
Thank you. Yeah, nice to meet you, too. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. Come on back.
French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey. The way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Top Taco and Gambit present the first ever Agave Week in New Orleans, kicking off with the world's largest Bloody Maria bar at Superior Grill on Sunday, March 11th. Featured events include paired dinners and tequila tastings at some of the best restaurants and bars in the city. Agave Week culminates on Thursday, March 15th with Top Taco, sponsored by Corona and the Paddle Wheeler Creole Queen at Waldenburg Park. 40 restaurants, 60 cocktails, and over 100 different tequilas will compete. The event benefits local foster children through One Heart NOLA. Check out toptaconola.com for tickets and more information.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, This Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint, and it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning in today. However you're listening to the show, be it here on radio in New Orleans or anywhere you may be on in the internet world. We're pleased to be joined by a repeat guest this time. It's always fun to do that. Eric Rubin from Spiritus Group. Eric, welcome back to the show, man.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Brian. Good to be back.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's good to see you. Last time you and I hung out and you were on the radio, I believe, was during Tales of the Cocktail. This last July here.
Yep, that would have been last July. So it's nice to be back. Nice to be back in New Orleans. And just actually came in directly from Guadalajara.
And you were saying that before. So everything is right at the tip of your tongue that we're talking about today here with the Agave Seminar and everything else.
Literally.
How was the trip, man?
The trip was great. It's always invigorating. It's always kind of reconfirms why we love agave spirits and tequila in particular.
Yeah. So what you down? Tell people a little bit about your role with the Spiritus Group, and just so they have an idea of what.
My role with the Spiritus Group is probably doing a lot of events like this for Blue Nectar, and also taking people down to Mexico. So, just usually groups of about 10 to 12 people seems to be about the right fit.
Now, how do I find my... I have not had one of those invitations yet, Eric, to be one of those 10 to 12 people. How do I find my way onto a trip with you to go to Mexico? I'm just shilling.
Consider it done.
Oh, okay.
Consider it done. Absolutely. So this past trip was mainly distributors and some good accounts, mainly from the state of Colorado, actually. But, of course, we also do media trips.
Oh, okay.
So, definitely can connect you up with one of those.
I was joking, but I'll take you up on it, man. So you're taking folks down, and you're showing them the distillery, you're showing them the agave production. I'm assuming you take them out to some of the fields, seeing some of the ag side of all this?
Yep, absolutely. And some of our favorite bars and restaurants, which, going down to Jalisco, I always tell people, and we touched on it during the last show, was that, I think with Americans, the one challenge we have with people going to Jalisco is that, most Americans think of Mexico as a beach destination.
Right.
And that's just the way it is. And then when people go and they go to the interior, to states like Jalisco, they're kind of like blown away going, wow, I just had no idea I was going to have this much fun going to the middle of the country.
It's beautiful, right? I mean, it's gorgeous. Obviously, Mexico is a huge country, as you're saying. So we do that all the time, right? We think Mexican food is one thing, and it's a big country with a lot of diversity.
It is, and supposedly Mexico has of all cuisines in the world, has the third highest number of recorded or documented recipes behind China and France.
I had never heard that before. That's really interesting.
That's a new one. So you just paid for my spot on the show right there.
Right, exactly. Knowledge is good. I'm happy to learn. I learn stuff every day, Eric, because I'm not that smart, man. So you were talking about with the Spiritus Group, and you mentioned Blue Nectar. This is the tequila brand in the Spiritus Group's portfolio, correct?
Yeah, and Blue Nectar is just doing terrific. We're happy to be in Louisiana finally. So we've been in Texas for, I want to say, 6 years, maybe. Louisiana is new, but it was probably long overdue, just because New Orleans is such a destination for people. It's a huge food and beverage destination. I mean, this is the primary reason people come here. We obviously was connected to Texas, so it made a lot of sense.
That's pretty cool. So, how long has the brand actually been around, Eric?
The distillery's been there since over 80 years.
Wow.
But really, they make it's just a family distillery that was basically found by the founders of Blue Nectar. And they'd never really had any brands make it to the U.S. Other than a few that just kind of find their way a little bit over the border.
Trickled over the border.
Yeah, right. Anytime I go to San Diego, I'm always like, hey, I haven't even seen that. And I know most all tequilas.
Right,
so sometimes things trickle over, but with the full support of a uh, you know, a sales and marketing staff and a portfolio company, which is what Aspiritus is.
Gotcha. Now, one of the things that we're doing today, Eric, is you're on a panel that's going on. It's an industry panel. We're going to talk about the tequila and mezcal industry in general. I'm moderating the panel, which I'm humbled to do. And you bring a lot of knowledge with the industry in general. We're going to talk about some important topics in the industry, not just the market itself, but we're going to touch on some things that might be a little sensitive to some people.
Yeah, they might be. And of course, a lot of the topics, you know, I think most of your listeners probably know about, which is that, you know, tequila's been booming now for, I mean, it's close to 20 years.
Right.
And to give you some numbers, even with the bourbon and whiskey category probably being the trendiest category in the last 2 years,
right,
tequila still showed huge growth. I mean, huge growth. And I always say that tequila's probably got more indirect drivers of volume, you know, just tons of Mexican restaurants. I mean, it's got the margarita, which, right, you know, which really no other spirit has that kind of driver,
right,
it's a nonstop driver of consumption. And now, you know, there's an old saying that, you know, it's a waste of good tequila to put it in a margarita. But like I always say, I always kind of jokingly say, well, if we put bad tequila into a margarita, then we're going to have a bad margarita.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
And so think of it that way. And, you know, a margarita is only as good or bad as the components. And, you know, another old kind of almost folkloric saying is that, you know, margaritas have a lot of calories. And once again, they've got as many calories as you put in there.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. Right. Exactly. That's a great way to put that. Well, and it's interesting, too, because I think a lot of people associate maybe the margarita with so-called top shelf margarita at a bar and grill place or frozen margaritas and things. And we know that the classic version of the margarita is just sugar or syrup of some form, lime, and tequila. So it really showcases. You're not hiding the tequila when you do it that way.
Yeah, that's it. And I think, you know, it's become kind of accepted, the three-ingredient margarita, which is kind of sans triple sec or orange liqueur of any type. And it really allows the quality and just the unique characteristics of all these different tequilas to really, really come to the forefront. And when you drink the three ingredient margarita, you're kind of like, oh, okay, I'm not confusing my palate with any kind of orange liqueur.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Now, Eric, you mentioned something. We got about a minute and a half left, but you're talking about the growth of tequila remaining very consistent in having its market share. But I think what we're seeing, right, is a lot of the premium and so-called super premium brands are really driving a lot of that growth, right? I think some of the so-called commodity stuff is a little bit stagnant these days, isn't it?
Well, certainly the what we call the mixto category,
yes,
which when you're down in Mexico, the CRT, the regulatory body, does not really like people to use that term, but it's just it's accepted.
Nor do certain producers.
It's true, but it's accepted, and the truth is it kind of makes sense because it's 51% agave. The other 49% made of other liquids.
Cane sugar or something like that, yeah.
Cane sugar, and you know, right now there's actually a lot. What I've seen the last couple of years is a lot of sorghum.
Oh, yeah.
Being grown in Mexico, which was a complete surprise a few years ago. But evidently, you know, it's really good to make up that added alcohol content.
Got it. Makes sense. Well, Eric, do me a favor. We got about 45 seconds left. Tell people where they can find information on Aspiritus Group, and then tell people where they can find information on Blue Nectar Tequila online.
It'd be best for Blue Nectar. Just go to bluenectar.com. And as far as Louisiana, I think you'll see it out in your favorite bars and restaurants. And, you know, obviously we're on radio, but if anyone happens to notice me in that bar or restaurant, I will gladly you know, treat you to a margarita or a Blue Nectar neat.
There you go. That's great. Take Eric up on his offer. Walk into a bar. If you see a bottle of Blue Nectar on the back bar, just yell out, "Eric Rubin, are you here? Buy me a drink."
You know, fair enough. It's not probably not real scientific, but it'll probably work.
It might work. Eventually, it'll have to work.
It'll have to work. Right, that's right.
Eric, thanks so much for taking some time, man. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Ryan. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
Look at my king, all dressed in red. I go one day. I bet you $5 he'll kill you dead. Chug a mofinane. Talking about hey now. I go one day. Chug a mofino anane. Chug a mofinane. My flag boy and your flag boy sitting by the fire.
my flag boy to your flag boy. I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about
here now.
I go one day.
Hey ladies, are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, friends, we are at the industry day for Agave Week, Top Taco, all that good stuff, and it's been fun having a lot of good food, a lot of good drink. And now I'm pleased to be joined by another guest, Evan Meeker, who is with Del Maguey, Mezcal. Yes, and I was asking you right before we went on the air here, man, what your title was, and you're a juez, which means judge, of course, in Spanish. But it's not what people are probably thinking. I was digging the story, man.
Certainly, certainly. So juez, J-U-E-Z, means judge, right? And you would automatically assume that that's to judge other mezcals, right? Which is not absolutely not the case. It's to judge whether your copita needs to be refilled. You know, little copita, little cup.
Yeah, tell people the little wooden cup traditionally, right?
To drink, to sip the mezcal out of. And so, it's my job to make sure that your copita is never empty.
I like that, man. That's a great title, and I got to hang out with you more often.
Yes, you do.
That's great. So you're with Del Maguey, which is, from my perspective, a pioneering brand in mezcal, especially as it exists or has been brought into the United States.
Certainly.
Can you tell us a little bit about the background on the company?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's more of a collective, is it not? Is that a?
I'd love to. Yes. Our company was founded by an amazing gentleman by the name of Ron Cooper. Who, you know, in my eyes and a lot of people, he really paved the way for the American palate, if you will, in terms of consuming mezcal. He brought in an expression that by the name of Chichicapa, named after the village where it's from, in 1995. And up until that point in the United States, we did not have a premium single village mezcal in the U.S. until Chichicapa. And so Ron did an amazing thing for this category, and he's still running around the U.S. Or maybe Mexico as we speak, you know, spreading the gospel. So
isn't he in Texas? Is that where he's based out?
No, he's either in Oaxaca, Mexico, or in Taos, New Mexico.
Oh, gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I think the idea, if I understand right, Evan, the nature of the company, when we call it a company, it's not like you have one distillery per se. You're working with a lot of independent producers, correct?
Exactly correct. Single village mezcal.
Yeah.
We work with families of agave farmers that happen to be mezcaleros, palanqueros, you know, in their own right, who are incredibly talented in both distilling and, you know, sustainable harvest or cultivation or forage of these different varietals of agave from Oaxaca. I've had the privilege to visit them several times, and it's always a humbling experience. And I take such pleasure in being able to talk about, you know, these products, you know, with you know, the consumer and our friends every
and
day.
Friends in the industry. Mm-hmm. I think it's really neat. One of the things that you guys do as a company too, I know, the commitment to the livelihood and the welfare of the families involved in the production of mezcal. As far as quality of life, working to make sure that people are being paid a fair wage for the product. And there's a sensibility, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but a sensibility of both cultural and environmental sustainability with your approach to production.
So much so. And that's something that Del Maguey, you know, that we really, really pride ourselves, and we talk about it a lot when we're out, you know, in, you know, working the market and being in the industry. You know, examples as such as what, you know, Ron, when he first started working with some of these families, I mean, you know, they were making beautiful mezcal, but they didn't have it set up into a way where they could make a larger quantity. So, you know, so maybe Ron purchased, you know, acres of land or an extra still, you know, and so they could set up and start having this influx of money, which, you know, where everything that they make, we buy. And then all of a sudden, opportunities opened in the ways where they can set up cell phone towers or maybe solar panels,
right?
Clean water projects, you know, to help, you know, safely remove of the waste that comes from distilling. So many different avenues. I mean, Ron, you know, he had set up some health clinics in Teotitlan, you know, so on and so forth, and just these people, just, you know, making money off of something they've done for, you know, made for generations. You
right.
know, it's an art form that they've made for generations.
And being paid a fair price for it as well, which I think is a huge issue here.
Absolutely. With us, it's actually three times generally, okay, if not more, of the growing rate of the fair price. And that goes everything down to the jimadoras, you know, who are actually harvesting the particular agave. So.
Right. And that's a huge issue, I think, with workers in the area. And you are on the panel that I'm moderating shortly coming up here at the event, talking about issues in the industry. And one of the things that when they asked me to do the panel, which I'm happy to do, I insisted that we talk about cultural equity, environmental sustainability, and address some of these issues, which are tough, as we talk about big ag and large tequila production. And I think you guys have had, from what I've seen, had a great commitment to this and addressing it in a fair, equitable, and I think honest way, right? Eyes wide open kind of way.
Oh, certainly. And it's incredibly important to be fully transparent in this issue, at least, you know, in the way that we feel. We have, you know, the pleasure, I guess, and the luck, not necessarily luck, but the relationship built mm-hmm. with these producers and have for 20 plus years, correct? So we've been able to forecast on how to build volume in business of our mezcals, but doing it sustainably because we're working with these same talented people for so long. And that all sends back to Ron Cooper. Now, with the explosion of this of the mezcal category and of course tequila as well, agave in general, there are people taking notes, so to speak, companies taking note that want to maybe grab a piece of this as quickly as they possibly can. And that's where there's a serious issue, because they're not paying attention to these social economic issues of sustainability. They're going down and just trying to make as much as quickly as they can. And and it could desecrate the resource, which is, of course, the maguey, the agave plant.
Yeah, which I think we're seeing really in a lot of cases, especially on the tequila side of things, more than the mezcal side of things. Let's shift gears a little bit. So you guys, because you're working with different village level production, the expression of your line, I've tasted through most of it, and it's exceptional. And I think a lot of people maybe think mezcal is a very one-dimensional spirit. The diversity of the portfolio that
it's
you guys
smoky,
have.
Right? It's smoky tequila.
Smoky tequila, right. The when you taste through what you guys have, and I think a few other brands demonstrate this, side by side, you realize the complexity and the diversity of mezcal.
It's terroir. When I do classes, I talk about this all the time, and I use a lot of comparisons of mezcal to wine, because, you know, just like you have different varietals of grapes, you have different varietals of agave that have different flavors. You know, if that varietal grows in a different area, it's going to taste different. So Chardonnay in California is incredibly different than Chardonnay in Burgundy, right? Well, okay, so Espadín from Chichicapa is incredibly different than Espadín from Santo Domingo Alvaradas,
right,
even though it's the same varietal. And that's really what it's about. It's the wine of the spirits world. And yes, it is smoky. Traditional mezcals should have that. It's actually not even smoke. It's roasted flavor, but of course everyone associates it with being smoke.
Right.
But it should have that flavor because that's the traditional way to cook the agave.
But when
you sit down and you taste them side by side, it really does open your eyes. And I highly encourage anyone who's listening to do this to not just try one, try multiple. Ron has a saying that you don't find mezcal finds you. And it was very much the case. It was the case for me, you know, 2007 in that, you know, when I was bartending and somebody brought me Chichicapa and I fell in love. And it's just keep trying different ones, and trying them side by side really opens your eyes to how beautiful these spirits are.
That's great, Evan. I think you made some good parallels when we talk about wine, because we teach people in the world of wine education, which I know a lot of listeners have done, tasting them side by side, not tasting them in a monolithic way. Having that that structure and the compare and contrast really helps you appreciate something and develop your palate for it, I think, too.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. I mean, you know, I can see how a lot of people would say that, you know, I mean, I fell in love right away, but, you know, some people, well, this is a bit of acquired taste. Yeah, sure. You got to acquire it, you know. Mm-hmm. But once you do, I mean, I was just talking to a gentleman a few minutes ago. I was like, man, the roasted flavor is secondary to me. I'm diving in and looking for the complexities, you know, all the other things, the tropical fruits, the minerality, right, the citrus, right, the pepper, the chili, the earth. You know, I'm looking for cheesiness, creaminess, butteriness. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm tasting when I'm drinking mezcal.
I dig it. I'm right with you, man. Do me a favor. We got about 20 seconds left. Tell people where they can find Del Maguey online, a little bit more information about the brand.
Certainly go to our website, which is delmaguey.com. And we are fully transparent in every single one of our expressions. And you can get just as much information on our website as anywhere. We have cocktail recipes from some of the best bars across the world. So if you're looking to mix a cocktail with Vita, that's a great place to start as well.
Excellent. Evan, thanks so much, buddy, for taking some
time.
My
pleasure. Thank
you. Look forward to doing the panel with you in a few minutes.
All right. Me too.
Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the show. Come on back.
For a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails, Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, friends, thank you as always for tuning in here to the NOLA Drinks Show. And we are at a fun event, or just after a really fun event. It's still fun going on. We are chatting here with Bernie Lebbers, who is the brand ambassador for Heaven Hill Distillery.
Hey, Brian. And,
hey, man. How you doing? It's nice
I'm
to meet
great.
You.
I'm great. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah. Thanks for taking some time. Dude, you just did a really cool thing. So we drank
you.
Whiskey, and we listened to bluegrass music, man.
How about that?
How about that?
On a Sunday, on the Lord's Day.
I can think of no better way to spend it than that,
right,
my friend. No
right?
doubt. No doubt about it. What a cool presentation, man. So you work with Heaven Hill Distillery as the ambassador.
Absolutely.
But you're picking and grinning, too, man.
Well, you know, as you heard in my presentation, I call Heaven Hill Distillery the biggest little distillery in the world. We're like Reno, Nevada.
So. Yeah, I like that.
So we're big because we are big. We're a large distillery. We make a lot of whiskey. We make the number 2 selling bourbon in the world, Evan Williams. We have Elijah Craig, Larceny, Rittenhouse Rye. But we're small because we're still family-owned and family-operated by the same family that started us in 1935. So if I worked, and I have worked for other company, very large company. I worked for Jim Beam for 7 years. Awesome company. Mm-hmm. Great brands. Great people. But, you know, there's a difference between a big company and a family-owned company. I was hired to do what I do. They say, you know what you're doing. You do what you do. I mean, you know, if this was a... If it was a large corporation, there would probably be an agency out of New York involved in writing this presentation for me.
Sure, absolutely, yep.
Which they don't know the history of whiskey, right? But they would have tried to write this thing, and I would, what songs go in it, and all kind of stuff. The family just said, you do what you do. Do it.
Yeah, do it.
So, Bernie?
It's pretty cool. I mean, I came up with this idea, myself and a bluegrass friend of mine who's a bluegrasser.
Yeah, okay.
We came up with this idea after a gig of his 5.5 years ago in a bar in downtown Louisville. And it's come to this. So, we do it with the band, too, at Camp Run Amok. And a couple of, we've done it at the House of Blues for Tales of the Cocktail a couple of years ago. And it takes many forms. Me solo, like you saw today. Me with Hickory. Hickory Vaught is my bluegrass partner in this. That's a different thing. We just did that at Island View Casino in Gulf Shores, Mississippi a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Awesome venue, and they wanted to bring in a couple hundred of their high rollers, and they thought this would be a pretty cool draw.
And did you do a similar thing where we were drinking whiskey?
Yeah, it's a little different because I'm with another guy.
Sure.
So the music is similar but different. And then what we do with the band.
Pairing whiskey and doing
absolutely. Yeah, we always taste our Heaven Hill whiskeys with it. And then tell the history of how bourbon became bourbon from unaged corn whiskey.
Sure.
To the whiskeys, small batch and single barrel and mainline whiskeys we have today. So when you, being that it's Kentucky whiskey we're talking about, Kentucky's very blessed with some great musicians and a couple genres of music, bluegrass music being one, and another gentleman Merle Travis, who does a style of music his own called Travis Style Picking.
Yep.
So there's two styles of music that come from Kentucky. Well, there's several styles of whiskey that come from Kentucky, so we pair those together, and I hope it turns out to be pretty cool.
Look, man, it makes a lot of sense. And actually, one of the things that we talk about here quite often, obviously, New Orleans is a town,
with tons of music history. Yeah.
So, pairing music and drink, and pairing music and food, whether you want to call it that, using that modern day term,
if there was a guy,
it's a natural thing. It happens.
I describe it to people, and it's a way that, it's too bad I can't describe it to what really happens. But if there was a guy or a girl from Mexico who's from Jalisco and played authentic Mexican folk music and paired it with tequila.
It happens every weekend.
I think I would go to that tasting.
Yeah, it happens every weekend.
And this is kind of what we do.
It's what you do, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm proud
of what we do here. We take authentic Kentucky music and we pair it with authentic Kentucky whiskey and tell the history of both. It's not just gratuitous music selling some whiskey. I mean, I really take pride in the fact I'm proud of what we do at Heaven Hill, and I'm proud of what we've done from the people have done in my state to put our music on the map. And everybody's got something they're proud of from their home state and their home and whatever. And that's fine.
I think we're blessed in Kentucky having all this stuff. Absolutely are. And I think what we're getting at here is that this is a natural occurrence, right? This isn't something that's forced. People were, as we're talking about, playing bluegrass music, listening to bluegrass music, getting together on a Sunday with family.
That's what they did.
Picking, like we're talking
they
about.
They went and to dances on the weekend.
And they're drinking whiskey.
And they're drinking whiskey.
Right. This is not something that's being recreated, as you said, in a sense. This is what people did and what people do.
Right.
Very much
now,
in
the some
world,
of them had to do it on the side because it was a very religious part of the country, too. So some of them had to kind of do it on the sly. And it wasn't really the most accepted thing, whiskey along with some of the areas of Kentucky and that. So that was a part of the history, too.
Yeah, right.
You're doing it kind of on the sly.
Yep.
But you're still, I mean, it's all together. We had prohibition for 14 years, and it was illegal. You had to do a lot of things on the sly.
Yeah,
we talked about that, too.
Absolutely.
So,
it's a cool presentation. It's a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And one of the things that, and I don't want to make this too overly local, but we were talking about, you asked the question when you played Kentucky Waltz, Bill Monroe, and it was one of my favorites. And you're talking about, and you ask the question, you know, why do they play a waltz? Well, the same thing goes on with Cajun music, right? Every third or fourth song, they'll people will be pissed if you don't play a waltz, because you got to
actually be a slow dance. You got to be able to hold your honey and slow dance with them.
Like say around here, it's a belly rubber, man.
So the Tennessee waltz, you know, the Tennessee waltz. There's a lot of Blue Moon of Kentucky. Those are all waltzes.
Yep.
So it was a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, country line dancing is all about the steps and the kind of rhythm. And they all have different steps. Well, the waltz is a different step. And as I described to you all, you know, in the 1939, when radio was a big deal and this recording was going on, and the Carter family in 1927 and Jimmy Rogers, no one had any money. So you couldn't buy a phonograph unless you were rich.
Yep.
And, of course, I can't give you a phonograph, and you can't afford the records to go along with it.
You can afford a radio.
You can afford a radio.
Or maybe a phonograph. That's
well, a friend of yours might be able to afford it. But a friend of yours might be able to afford a radio, and that's whose house you would go to.
Right, exactly.
And go listen to it live. And they were batteries. They didn't want to run their batteries down during the week.
Yep.
So they saved the battery for Saturday night. The Saturday night barn dances were the biggest barn dances. It had the best musicians and the best programming, and that these barn dances were broadcast. And because WSM Radio had the strongest signal of 50,000 watts from Nashville, Tennessee, the Grand Ole Opry Barn Dance was the most listened to barn dance in the country.
It heard all over the place. And I think, you know, people, well, and not to get too far off track here either, but with New Orleans, the radio station WWL out of here and some other places,
well, there you
because
go.
Their bandwidth was so high that you...
Right. And at night, especially, it broadcast.
Yeah, so people, you know, this is how R&B music was actually heard in Jamaica.
Sure. And of course... Then you had the border radio out of Mexico across the border in Texas and in California. And, of course, they had 100,000, 150,000-watt stations. Johnny Cash used to joke that he could listen to the Carter family. If he put a tin can up to a barbed wire fence, he could hear the Carter family play because it was such a hot signal that any wire would pick it up.
Yeah.
So this is I believe this is a part of history we don't talk about. And I try to bring a little bit of it alive because you can't separate that history from they're going to be drinking something socially with this music.
Listening to tunes, man. Yeah.
And I try to bring this alive with this presentation. So I'm glad it resonates with folks. And I have folks who aren't music fans, but they particularly say, well, I don't like bluegrass music or never thought I did. But when somebody describes to you why something is happening and why it was, like the reason that we have jukeboxes is because no one could afford a phonograph or albums.
Yep.
So to go out to a bar or restaurant and to put a penny in a jukebox and you could play a luxurious item like a phonograph and a song you wanted to hear.
Yep.
Because you weren't going to hear it unless you put a penny in there.
Unless you put a penny in. Exactly.
Well, so that made Bernie, the every person thing.
Hold that thought. Yeah. We're going to come back. We're going to take a little commercial break.
We didn't even talk about whiskey yet.
We're going to get to that because we got some in our glass.
Sorry we got off track.
Yeah, no, this is right on track, bro. Right on track. Friends, we're chatting with Bernie Lubbers, who is the brand ambassador, whiskey ambassador for Heaven Hill Distillery. We're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show. Come on back.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bajot heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Afternoon when I wake up, I say a little prayer.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today, friends. Yeah, we're at Barrel Proof. We're in the, as I like to say, the lower Garden District, because you can't get any lower in the Garden District than this. And down in the LLG, here we are.
LLGD?
Yes, they're calling it the LLG. I've made that up, Bernie, actually, the lower Garden District. But we're chatting with Bernie Lubbers, who is the brand ambassador for Heaven Hill Distilleries, and we were talking about your presentation that you did today, playing some bluegrass music, drinking some whiskey. I'm intrigued, man. So we were talking about a little bit about your background. Well, we didn't really get into your background. You have a performance background, man. So you did. You said you said you did stand up comedy for 20 years.
I was a professional stand up comedian from 1985 to 2005.
Okay,
I played down here at in Metairie at the old Punchline.
No way.
In the day, okay. Comedy zones in the area, things like that.
Yeah.
I've been coming down here for 30 years.
Where are you from, man? Did you grow up in Kentucky?
Louisville, Kentucky.
You're from Louisville.
Born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky. Still live there. Love it. I mean, it's the heart of everything. I mean, I've traveled all my life. So 3 weeks a month. Since 1985, so I get to come to great cities, see the best and the worst of cities, you know, and which means that when I go home, I see the best and worst of what we do at home. But we don't have a lot of traffic at home. Our cost of living is pretty good, so I don't see a need to move. I love staying put, but I also love coming down to New Orleans once, twice a year, going to San Francisco once, twice a year, New York, Chicago. Nashville, all that kind of stuff. So
bluegrass festivals in Slovakia.
That's a true story.
I enjoy
that
story, man.
It's a great story.
Yeah. Checking out bluegrass music festival. And, so obviously, growing up in Louisville, then and doing what you did, what came first? I mean, you're around bourbon, you're around bluegrass music
and beer.
And beer.
My grandfather founded a brewery. I never knew my grandfather. He was passed away before I was born. But my dad worked there for 45 years. Fall City Brewing Company out of Louisville, Kentucky. They made a national beer called Billy Beer. From Billy Carter.
They made Billy beer. Serious?
Yeah.
No way. Okay, right on.
That was a money grab. That was fine. You know, it was a fad. But
so was Billy Carter.
Right. But my family was a beer and bourbon family. My mom and my dad both drank beer and bourbon, and that was what we drank at home. I mean, my parents rubbed bourbon on my gums when I was teething.
Yeah.
We all got sips of beer and bourbon when we were growing up. I mean, we didn't. You know, we went to parties in high school and people were going crazy and drinking because we were like, this is silly. I mean, if I want to drink, I'll just get a drink.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a big deal. We didn't. So it was great. You know, I grew up Catholic, so we were drinkers. So it wasn't forbidden. But, you know, it's a great environment to grow up in. I did the stand-up comedy for 20 years.
How did you get into that? How did that happen?
It was a passion. It's what I wanted to do.
Okay.
You know, I worked at a bank and I hated it. So, in 1985, the comedy world was kind of busting open, and you could get work. You didn't have to be funny. As long as you could MC a show and keep the show moving along, if you were funny, it was a bonus. And I happened to be funny on top of being able to make the show move along. And so I was a 20-year, 85, 95, a 20-year career. 160 cities in 20 years. So it was awesome. Worked with people like Tim Wilson and Howie Mandel and Steve Harvey, different folks. I mean, these are Drew Carey. These were all people we just worked with all the time. We just knew them all the time. I could talk to Drew Carey today and we could talk about walking around Cleveland and having a good time. I mean, nobody would care how famous anybody is. I'm not famous. And in his mind, he's not famous. He's one of the most down to earth people on the planet.
Okay.
But it's like, you know, it's just what you do. When they were looking for people to be ambassadors for brands, the distillers didn't. They weren't really the best people to get in front of a group of
people.
They're
not people.
And talk.
People. Right.
I had that ability, and so I was hired to. After I was already in the industry, I kind of snuck my way into the industry in the back door, and then I kind of made myself available. And I saw that's the goal I want. I want to be that, and. Then I was able, because I talked to people, I wrote my own presentations. I didn't just do the presentations that the brand team sent down or the marketing department did. And it kind of put my name on the map a little bit. And then I became an ambassador after a year and a half. And when the small batch and single barrel bourbons over at Jim Beam, when I worked there, were Knob Creek and Basil Hayden and Booker's and Baker's. And working with Fred Noe over there was amazing. And then made a name for ourselves, and then Heaven Hill needed somebody, and they called me. So it was really nice.
That's cool.
So I went from the number one bourbon company in the world to the number two bourbon company in the world, and so I've worked for both.
That's not bad.
Jim Beam makes great whiskey, and it's a great company. I'll never say a bad thing. This was an opportunity that presented itself, and let me tell you, it's just a little bit different at a company that's family-owned and family-operated, because the Shapira family, is quite amazing. They're true kingpins of the industry. that know every facet of their own business. They're not just figureheads of their industry, of their business. Okay. They run their business, and they run it very well.
Yeah.
And we have become the number two selling bourbon in the world and the number six supplier in the United States. And we are a powerful force for still being. That's why I call us the Reno, Nevada of distilleries. We're the biggest little distillery in the world.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good analogy. And it sounds like it's also allowing you to continue to pursue some of your passions in
I do what I do, and they leave me alone. I mean, nobody else. I couldn't do this for Diageo or for Bacardi. I mean, they would take control of it, and they would want to make, what are you doing? Right, you got to follow this script.
So, Bernie, when did you pick up the guitar, man?
College.
Start doing that.
I played the organ.
Okay. Like every white guy in college like me, started playing guitar.
Keyboards in the 70s. I played the organ.
The organ, yeah.
Uh-huh. So I played weddings and funerals.
Okay.
And I've always been an entertainer, and I was good at it. I played a good organ, right? But no, I never learned how to play the piano, so I'm lost on the piano. And nobody plays the organ anymore. I don't even know if I can play the organ anymore. But
those weighted keys are tough, man.
And the pedals. Uh-huh. But so I knew when I went to college I wanted to play an instrument, so I picked the guitar up as a sophomore in college, and I've been playing ever since. I've just been strumming, though, and doing that thing. It's only been in the last 10 years that I've been exposed to my buddies who are bluegrass pickers that we hired to help us with bourbon tastings and that. Yep. And I've noticed how great Kentucky bourbon whiskey matches with Kentucky music, bluegrass music.
It's organic, right?
I've just kind of built that, and it's made me it's helped me realize my lifelong dream of being a bluegrass musician, which is a horrible goal. You make tens of dollars, and but it's a passion. There's a passion, and then what you do for a living. Now I get to put my two things together: being an entertainer. My comedy kick, I hope it's entertaining. I hope it's extremely informative too.
Yeah,
to a lot of history of whiskey and that, and to do it with live bluegrass music is I'm blessed. I mean, it's pretty cool.
It's a lot of fun, man. I enjoy the presentation greatly. And actually, when Stephen Wilshire, who is the local rep here, invited me,
a musician
to come
in his own right.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? And I said, I'm not going to miss this.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's perfect, man.
And then we bring the whiskey alive because, whiskey started out as unaged corn whiskey.
Right.
Then it moved into aged corn whiskey. And then finally it moved into bourbon decades later. So to put that evolution, when I play a song about making corn whiskey in Kentucky in the early 1800s, and you're sipping a whiskey that would have been served in the early 1800s.
Right.
Hopefully that resonated and came through. Yeah. Like, this is kind of special.
Yep. It actually makes a lot of sense. It's very similar to what happens here in New Orleans as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a long-standing history with all kinds of spirits, cognac one in particular. People sitting around drinking and listening to music is something we've done since the dawn of time, right? Mm-hmm. So your presentation, actually, it's fun to see a little Kentucky down here in New Orleans because there's a lot of shared aspect of that.
Well, there's no doubt that bourbon got its name either from this city.
Yes.
Or from the county that it came from in Kentucky.
Right. Now,
we can debate that back and forth.
Right. And let's do this. We're going to take a commercial break because I don't want to go too far down that road just yet. But we're going to take a little break here, friends. We're chatting with Bernie Lubbers from Heaven Hill Distillery. Come on back.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature made the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of New Orleans, affirming what New Orleanians had known for over 150 years. You just can't beat a good Sazerac. The Sazerac cocktail is the quintessential New Orleans drink, perfect for celebrating the arrival of fall festivals, football season, or just being proud to be a New Orleanian. For the official recipe, visit www.sazerac.com.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
The French Market offers daily entertainment and delicious food and drink options throughout our 6-block district.
Whether you crave raw oysters or fresh produce, authentic confections or healthy daiquiris, you can find it here. Sit at one of our cafes and hear live local music. Enjoy a muffaletta, po' boy, salad, or cheese plate in the farmer's market. Check out our pop-up farmer's markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays for even more fresh food options. History is being made fresh daily at the French Market. Visit frenchmarket.org for food, drink, retail, and event listings.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning into the show as
always. Brian, what's up?
Hey, Bernie, how you doing, man?
I'm great.
Awesome. Hey, we're chatting with Bernie Lubbers here, who is the brand ambassador, whiskey ambassador for Heaven Hill Distilleries, straight out of Louisville, Kentucky. So, Bernie, to this point, we've talked about bluegrass music in your presentation. We've talked about all kinds of different things. Let's talk a little bit about what's in our glass in front of us, my
friend,
right now.
The whiskey.
Yes, yes, yes.
So at Heaven Hill Distillery, our mission statement for the distillery is to make every style of American whiskey, and we do. We make an unaged corn whiskey in Georgia Moon. We make an aged corn whiskey in Mellow Corn. We make rye whiskey in our Pikesville and our Rittenhouse rye, and that's what we're going to taste here, this first one, Rittenhouse
yep.
rye.
There we go.
You know, this is what people were making up north in New York, Pennsylvania, and Maryland when our country was founded. Rye is a grass. It's a seed, but it's grass. It grows anywhere. And it's prevalent in cooler climates.
Right.
It will grow anywhere.
Grows but, well in the winter, which is yep, helpful, right?
It grows in the winter, so you can do that. That and wheat grow
yep.
in the winter.
Yep.
So this is obviously made it into beer recipes, and thus you take beer and distill it and get whiskey. So obviously it made it into recipes. No one planned on this. It was just you just whatever was growing in your field. You know, Benjamin Franklin back in the day said, "In wine there is wisdom."
Yep.
In beer there is freedom, and in water there is bacteria.
Bacteria, right.
So you were more likely to drink a beer or a wine with every meal. And, of course, it's only about 2% alcohol. It's not like the beer and wines we have today.
Yeah, so you're not getting dehydrated.
Right.
Right.
And yep. man, women, and child drank it yep. because you would get yep. sick off the water.
Yep.
So then they would take that beer and wine, and they would distill it. It was legal for everybody in the United States to have a pot still that was 50 gallons or less for personal distillation. And you would take that beer and wine and distill it, and you would either get brandy with wine
yep.
or you'd get whiskey with
beer.
The beer.
Yep.
So that's why we started this. It wasn't like you're sipping and savoring this next to a fire with your friends. You might start the fire with it, but you're not. It only was after we did barrels and aged it and had that evolution and that thing going on that we have the whiskeys that we have today. So this Rittenhouse rye is indicative of what they were drinking in Pennsylvania and you know, the early, late 1700s, George Washington made a rye whiskey
right,
at Mount Vernon.
Mount Vernon, yeah.
So this has an explosion of spice in your mouth with a finish of vanilla, honey, and caramel.
What's Bernie, what's the mash bill on this one, on the Rittenhouse?
51% rye, 35% corn, and 14% malted barley.
Yep.
It's just it's about half and half of spicy and sweet, and it's indicative of what folks were making back then. And it's just a beautiful whiskey. It's the whiskey that was used in the Sazerac cocktail.
I was just going to go there, man.
There was a hard to get the cognac.
Yep.
And that, you know, so Sazerac cognac was used in the first Sazerac, and then they switched to a rye whiskey.
This is you anticipated where I was going to go, because the Rittenhouse rye is the rye of choice for many bars here in New Orleans and in many places for making a proper Sazerac. And it's,
you know, Rittenhouse rye. Yep. And I've been all over the world, but I've been to Slovakia, I've been to Czech Republic, I've been to Germany, I've been to Austria, I've been to the UK. It is the most sought after rye whiskey in the world. It's not a huge brand for us. It's an important brand for us because with the mixology world, and of course here we are in New Orleans, the birthplace of the cocktail. This is a important whiskey,
yep.
and this is an important brand. There's only a couple brands that are so heralded as to you must use this in a cocktail. In Rittenhouse rye in New York City, San Francisco, Chicago, you know, Louisville, Nashville, Slovakia, Rittenhouse is one of those.
Where do you see the rye category going, man? It's going places, I think.
It's going places. It's still on such small numbers. You know, anytime you want to get cocky about stuff, there's things to put it in its place. Jack Daniels, which is a big brand and an important brand and a great brand, outsells the entire bourbon and rye category combined.
Right, right.
So let's not think about numbers of cases sold. We like to think of it as usage.
I like
and
that.
How it's used and the proper usage of it. Because yeah. We're a family-owned company, the Shapiras understand this is an important brand for us to engage with the mixologist and the on-premise bar and restaurant.
Hey, in certain markets like this one, it's really important.
This market is
exemplary of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. We're such a small company, part of that small part. We don't have hundreds and hundreds of salespeople around the country. We have dozens. So the brands speak volumes. So it's the people who work in this industry that seek out Rittenhouse Rye. Our poor salespeople don't have time to get it known to everybody. This is the power of this brand. This is a powerful brand. If you've never had Rittenhouse Rye, you need to go get a bottle and see what you're missing out on. It's amazing.
Yeah, go order a Sazerac and file.
It's $25 a bottle, by the way. This ain't an expensive bottle.
Well, Bernie, tell us a little bit. So we're gonna shift gears a little bit. We're gonna go to the McKenna here.
Henry McKenna is a bottle and bond, which also Rittenhouse Rye is. Bottle and bond is a bottle and bond bourbon. It's also a single barrel, and so it checks off all the boxes. It is the oldest age-stated bottle and bond on the planet. It's 10 years old. It's 100 proof. Bottle and bond is a set of restrictions. So it has to come from one distillery, one distilling season. It has to be from at least a minimum of 4 years old. This happens to be 10 years old.
Yep.
It has to be exactly 100 proof. You have to list the name of the distillery on the package. You have to list the distillery plant number. So because it has all these designations, I call it the Eagle Scout of spirits. It's the Navy SEAL Green Beret of spirits. So why wouldn't you want it?
Yeah.
This is a $35 bottle of bourbon, and anything equivalent to it is $90 to $200 a bottle. Because we're family-owned, we think, our family believes, that whiskey should be enjoyed by the average American. You will see these prices rise. We're not stupid. We are in the bourbon business, not the bourbon charity.
Sure.
But we're not going to get crazy with it like a lot of people are. And we don't have to because we're kind of big. But we do need to take advantage of this boom. And we don't want to have to go out of business because we're too hard-headed.
Yeah, right. That makes a lot of sense.
So, bear with us. You know, we're still great at the prices. But you will see them rise. But don't worry. It's not going to be out of control.
Not going to knock. Yeah. And as you said, the average person drinking whiskey, I mean, this is... Breaking bread and drinking is a tradition that goes back millennia. Yeah. So nobody's reinventing anything here in this conversation.
No. There's only 5 or 6 10-year-old age-stated American whiskeys.
Yeah, right.
And they're not $35.
Right, yeah. Exactly. They're a little more than that. Apparently, there's something called the secondary market for such things. I'm not sure what that means, but
Yeah. You know, and it's great. You know, that puts a lot of spotlight on what we're doing. It shows you how great all the distilleries are doing. Heaven Hill, here's how I describe it. Everybody has a house style. So when you talk about tequilas and mezcal and cognacs and armagnacs, you talk about a house, wines, beer, you talk about a house style.
Yep.
Our house style is to, because we're larger and we have, our stuff's paid for. Okay? We've been doing this long, 82 years.
Yeah, that's a big thing in this industry.
It's a big deal. You're not pushing a rock up. You know, we're investing a lot of our own money, but stuff. So we typically, because we can afford it and shoulder the costs, we typically keep our products in the barrel just a little bit longer than our main competitors. Then we put it in the bottle just a little bit stronger than our main competitors. And then we do something really sneaky. We charge less for it than our main competitors. Now, we could charge more for it and do more billboards and advertisements and magazines and on TV, but we would choose to keep that in the bottle for our customers, which are either bars and restaurants or a consumer who's buying them, and have them recognize they're getting something in an amazing length in the barrel, an amazing strength in the bottle, at an amazing price. And if you build it, they will come.
Yeah, there you go.
And they have come.
Awesome.
So we're going to be advertising Evan Williams and Larceny and Elijah Craigmore.
Okay.
But anything else is going to be organic until it shows. It's like the gopher, you know, whack-a-mole. When it shows itself, you know, you got to whack it a little bit. So, right. You know, brands will do that. And, you know, we're in the bourbon business, not the bourbon charity. When the mole comes up and we got to advertise that we're going to. But until then, we have a lot of brands that are going to be organic, and we're going to keep the prices of all we do pretty low.
Well, in a place like this, a Barrel Proof here at the 1200 block of Magazine Street, that's your best advertising, right?
I mean,
that's how that works.
American whiskey should be enjoyed with family and friends, and you shouldn't have to save up 2 weeks' salary to be able to buy a round for your friends.
There you go.
You can buy a Evan Williams Extra Age Black Label, and it won't wreck your budget. And you can even buy Elijah Craig or Henry McKenna for your friends, and you can still make your rent and pay your electric bill.
And make
bill.
Them happy. All right, Bernie, we got to close this out, man. Tell people where they can find more information about Heaven Hill online.
www.heavenhilldistillery.com.
Pretty easy.
Pretty cool.
Awesome. Bernie, thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks,
absolutely,
Brian.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
A pleasure. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Dole Drink Show. Come on back.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Goodbye, Joe. I got to go, me old Mayo. I gotta go pull a P-Roll down the bayou. My advice is the sweetest one, me old Mayo. Son of a gun, we're gonna have big fun on the bayou.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the program. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land wherever you may be. Hope you enjoyed that fun and lively and entertaining conversation with Bernie Lubbers. He's a real character. I enjoyed talking to him, and that was a fun day there at Barrel Proof when we taped that. Couple programming notes, friends. Next week, we're going to be talking about a lot, at least in part. Some of these interviews have already been done, but I got to kind of figure out if we're going to run these over two shows or if this is going to be mostly next week. But we're going to be talking with some of the folks that are vending food at French Quarter Festival. What happened just the other day was that French Quarter Festival had an event where the vendors came. They brought and showcased their dishes to the folks at French Quarter Festival, as well as to the media. Lots of great eats coming up. So I sit down and talk with different folks that are going to be selling food. One of them is the proprietor of Winks Bakery, who is, of course, Dwight Henry, star of Beasts of the Southern Wild and other films. Really great chat with him. So that'll be mostly what's going on next week, if that makes sense. And also, I wanted to let you know, too, if you do listen to the podcast, you want to catch this later on the podcast. Normally, it comes out the day after it airs on the radio. Thursday comes out on a
Friday, but due to some of these Top Taco and Agave events and some other things I've got on my plate, the podcast will actually be out on Saturday, so apologies for any hassles there. Here's an event that I want to flag your attention to, because tickets are going to sell out really fast. Next week is the second annual Bloody Mary Festival taking place here in New Orleans. It's put on by the Bloody Mary Liberation Army is the name of the group. They do some of these in different spots around the country. And it's Saturday, March 24th and Sunday, March 25th. The Saturday event is actually already sold out, both sessions. There are still tickets for Sunday. So how this works, there are two sessions, 12 to 2, session number one, and 2:30 to 4:30. Session two takes place at Howlin' Wolf, which is the famed music club, of course, at 907 South Peters Street. And you get to enjoy all kinds of people's takes on both the traditional and the non-traditional Bloody Mary. Going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to be out there judging the competition, so come say hi. Tell me what you think about what you're tasting. Go check that event out. The website is thebloodymaryfest.com, or you can find their event very easily on Facebook as well, and get yourself some tickets before they sell out. I have a sneaky suspicion that Saturday's gone, as I said. Sunday's going to sell out pretty quick, too. So go check out the Bloody Mary Festival and come say hi to me. So circling back, friends, yesterday on the industry event for Agave Week connected to Top Taco, happening just right after the close of this show, I'm going to be wandering over there to go judge some cocktails there too. So that's going to be a lot of fun. But you know, I touched on the state of the industry thing at the beginning of the show. I touched on a little bit of changing perceptions of tequila and mezcal as far as how people enjoy it and how it is served. There's some important social issues to understand here, friends, that are going on with this. We've talked a fair bit about mezcal and tequila on the show. We will continue to talk about it. It is a very interesting agricultural product, agave is. This plant takes several years to mature, to proper maturation. Now, one of the things that you have to know is that some of these are cultivated, some agaves and some production methodology, some companies, some farmers cultivate them, as you would imagine from, you know, farming. Some are semi-cultivated and some are completely wild. Now, they mature at different rates, as I was saying, and even in some cases, the same species in a very neighboring area, maybe slightly different in terroir, or really not even necessarily in different terroir at all, will mature at different rates. And these take years, often 6 to 15 years for an agave plant to have matured enough to be usable to make mezcal. Now, I'm just going to use the term mezcal because all tequila is mezcal. Things made from agave are mezcal. Tequila, as we probably know, has to come from blue agave, at least in the case. Premium tequila has to come from, or as it does, comes from 100% blue agave. They say it on the bottle, the mixto stuff that I was talking about, where it's 51% agave. That's still going to be blue agave, okay? There are about 30 to 40 species of agave used in the broader area of making mezcal. So I'm just going to call it mezcal because that's really what tequila is as well. So 6 to 15 years for a plant to mature. Now, in the traditional way of doing this, you know, you hand select the agave. It's very labor intensive. You have to break the plant down. You have to use a couple different methodologies that people typically use to cook the plant, extract the sugars, you know, ferment, and then distill and make the spirit. It's very complex. The traditional methods are very labor intensive, all the way from farm to still, if you will. When what we've got, though, because of the growth, because of its popularity, and then because of big brands and big ag moving in, people are trying to take shortcuts. And I mean shortcuts. I don't mean efficiency, because really what ends up happening is that it might be quicker and it might be cheaper, but what you're getting is a lower quality product, and you're also getting a product that puts a significant strain on the environment. This is a very complex issue, but this is the case. So a good example of this is some of the larger brands, especially some of the cheaper tequilas, they will have a field of agave. They use a lot of pesticides. They use a lot of fertilizer with the idea that they're trying to increase the maturation rate. You can imagine, like, this doesn't work with a lot of ag anyway, that the quality of the plant's not going to be great, but they just come in and in one fell swoop harvest at a given time. So the variation that you're going to get in that of these agave plants being actually ripe is going to vary. It's going to affect quality, as I said. It also creates a situation with environmental sustainability. The biodiversity is threatened by this. Typically, what needs to happen is that, you know, some agave plants have to mature past where they're usable for distillation and making a spirit to flower. So things like long-nosed bats, which are the main animal that does this, or in many cases hummingbirds that pollinate the plant. This really isn't going on. They're trying to propagate them in artificial ways to do that. We're really harming biodiversity. And what's happening is we're really, especially with blue agave, we're really monocropping. And what does that mean in reality?
here for the sake of the plant anyway, and really our ability to get it in the bottle, is that, you know, hey, it's not going to take much, because there is no biodiversity within the blue agave world, that, you know, a disease or some sort of pest infestation could basically wipe it out. So that's one problem. But there's also, because of the popularity, there is a huge shortage, and the price really hasn't gone up with mezcal enough, and with most brands anyway, especially the cheaper stuff, to reflect the realities of production. People need to be paid a fair wage, those that are actually doing this, working hard in the field, distilling, all that stuff. That's a really important part of this as well. But the price of agave keeps going up. It's gone up and has had linear growth over the past few years. It's doubled almost, or not quite that, but close to that, just even since last year. So the price of the bottle basically has to go up. Something's kind of got to give here, friends, which is really what my point is we've either got to pay more, or it's got to, you know, it's going to be made in a different, less expensive way. And not the way I'm talking about right now. I mean, they're going to have to expand the geographic ranges or what's acceptable to call tequila, or create another category, which they're never going to do for a marketing reason, and call it something else, but, you know, a slightly agave based spirit. We're going to have to pay more is really the reality of this. If we want to continue to have the spirit of mezcal and tequila, as you know, made in a correct way. And what I mean by correct is just a well-made way, where the people that are making it are getting paid a living wage. The environmental component, the agricultural component of this, is sustainable. So there is not a boom or bust kind of consideration, which can really happen here. You know, I know it's probably not articulating this as well as I should, because we would really need a lot more time to get into this. I guess the take-home message here, friends, is that, you know, if you want to pay $15 for a bottle of tequila, you're going to have to ask yourself some questions. If you want to buy something that is both good in quality and fair in trade, you need to pay some premium prices. And I think we need to start supporting those brands that do that. You're going to get a better spirit, you're going to get a better product, and you're supporting an industry that is far, far more sustainable than what I'm going to call subsidized commodity tequila, because that's really what this is. So we'll get more into this, friends, on future shows, and we'll carve further, as we've done in the past, but carve further into this issue and understanding what it means to your pocketbook, what it means to your palate, and what it means to the folks that actually make it, and the folks that make it in a traditional way, and protecting their life and their livelihood. Friends, thanks for tuning into the show today. As I mentioned, we're going to talk a lot more next week about French Quarter Festival. Good food, drink, and music going on there. They released their schedule today fully, where everybody's playing, when, where, what stage, all that. That just came out. So go check out FrenchQuarterFestival.org for that. So there you go. Friends, be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all.